Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Have you ever heard of a barracuda, also known as a bilker, a bunco, a hustler, a swindler, a crook, or, perhaps most familiar, a con man?
Barracuda.
I know, isn't that cool?
One of those?
That is a synonym for a con artist.
I've never heard this before, Ben.
Well, neither have I, Noel. Have you, super producer Casey Pegram?
That is not a usage I'm familiar with.
Let's bring it back.
I think we should.
Welcome to the show. This is Ridiculous History. And I've got to say, Noel, you know how sometimes, I don't know if this happens to you, sometimes when I'm doing research, I'll fall into a tangential rabbit hole.
Of course.
So in our time researching this episode, I fell into a rabbit hole of con artist culture.
And synonyms, clearly.
Mm-hmm. And grifters. Oh, we should have said grifter. That's my favorite. And all the different slang terms attributed to this subculture, this industry. And today's show does ultimately concern what I have to say is an objectively impressive grift.
Yeah, an objectively impressive grift from an objectively detestable human person.
Oh, yeah. Oh, terrible. Garbage train of a person for sure. And often described as an adventurer. Which seems like a cool job title, but we'll find in his case is maybe a little more generous than he deserves. But Noel, could you introduce us to this fellow, Gregor McGregor?
Gregor McGregor sounds made up, but wait till you hear his other name. He once was a rosy-cheeked young lad from the Scottish Highlands. Mm-hmm. He came from fighting stock, as this fantastic article from History Today by Victor Allen points out. You see, his grandfather was a well-known Klansman. That's not a Ku Klux Klansman, a Klansman in the Scottish tradition, whose name in Gaelic was Gregor the Beautiful. And he was a member of something called the Black Watch, mm-hmm. and also kind of became an important figure in a region called Inverdeen in Breadalbane. And he became something called a laird, which I imagine to be a lord.
Right, right. And those terms are also not made up. We have to point out that this Gregor the Beautiful thing was probably not meant sarcastically, like Little John or something.
No.
He wasn't a super ugly dude.
No, I think he was probably a bit of a hunk because his grandson, Gregor, in all the portraits that we've been able to find of him, a pretty dashing figure.
Real smoke show. Real,
absolutely. Yeah, snack. Absolutely. Welcome to the... Wow. Wow, Ben. You got some feels about Gregor.
Oh, no. I just wanted an excuse to use this wonderful phrase that John Oliver used recently.
Oh, what? A smoke show or a snack?
Absolute snack.
That's good.
He described it, and I thought, wow, John Oliver, that's pretty racy
for
you.
And I'll tell you, one thing that's very snackable about him are his delicious mutton chops, because they are a thing of beauty, my friend. So he had a military career, a pretty storied military career,
sure,
didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. He had years and years of service in the British Army. And let's talk a little bit about how he got wrapped up in all these military shenanigans and escapades. McGregor, you see, joined the British Army at 16, which was you have to be at least 16 to join the Army at this time. He joined in April 1803. Oh, wait, we have to go back. Did we say when he was born? December 1786.
Crucial.
Yes.
Crucial deed.
Crucial deed. The 24th of December, in fact. Anyhow, fast forward, he's 16, April of 1803, he signs up for the British Army. His family had purchased a commission for him to serve as an ensign in the 57th West Middlesex Regiment of Foot.
What do you mean purchased a commission for him? They like bought his way into a cushy military job?
Yeah, bought his way to officer status. So it cost around £450.
Interesting.
Because his family's pretty well off at this point.
Sure.
You know, he's got
he's a laird.
Yeah, he's got a landed grandfather, right. So when he enters the military, funny story, at the same time, something called the Napoleonic Wars is occurring in Europe.
I feel as though we've heard of this before.
I think so. Longtime listeners may have a vague image of bunnies hopping into their heads.
Yeah, and steamy fanfic involving our boy Napoleon and Alexander the Tsar of Russia.
Yes, it was bizarre, to say the least.
It's worth it.
Thank you. I'll be here for the rest of the show.
Good. I need you. I need you, Ben. I need you.
Are you going to stay for the rest of the show, too?
We'll see.
Okay, great. We'll play it by ear. And that's what McGregor was doing.
Nice.
Thanks. So he does serve in the military, and at this time, he is actually doing the work. In February of 1804, less than a year into his training, he is promoted without purchasing a commission. So he earns the rank of lieutenant. And this is important because that kind of advancement usually takes much longer, like 3 years.
Yeah. And what was he, like, in his 20s?
He would still not be 20. He would be around, like, maybe just about to turn 18.
This is in
1804.
That's right.
And as he is serving the British Army, he is still networking with people. He meets the daughter of a Royal Navy admiral named Maria Bowater, and she had a pretty hefty dowry.
Didn't he wife her up?
He did. He wifed her up. He also bought the rank of captain for about £900, and he could have waited to get the promotion to earn it, but that would have taken 7 years, and he was a man on a mission.
A lot of palms being greased in this situation, aren't mm-hmm. there, Ben?
Yeah.
And I think we're already seeing some foreshadowing of our boy Gregor McGregor's slippery nature.
That's right, Noel, and we see his extroverted nature go international pretty soon when he is in his 20s. He doesn't just stay in Europe, you see. He is intrigued by the colonial revolts against Spanish rule in Latin America, particularly Venezuela.
Venezuela, and he kind of joins forces or offers his services to, I guess, this guy, Simon Bolivar.
Bolivar,
right, who is like the head or the leader of this kind of rebellion. His nickname was the Liberator, in fact. Earned that nickname by liberating what is now the republics of Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Panama, and Bolivia, made them sovereign states and freed them from Spanish rule. And this is all in the midst of that hubbub there, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So how does a young Scotsman throw his hat in the ring to a revolt like this? I guess they needed all the help they can get, or what?
Mm-hmm. They need all the help we could get. Also, we should point out that in December of 1811, Maria McGregor had passed away. So he is now no longer a married man. When he arrives in Venezuela, it's not long after an earthquake has destroyed a lot of the city. This is in April of 1812. Some of the country was under control of advancing royalist armies. The revolutionary government was starting to collapse on itself and break into different factions. McGregor didn't want to talk about his titles in his European life. He wanted to seem pretty legit to the Republicans. So he kept calling himself Sir Gregor, and then he started claiming he was a knight of the Portuguese Order of Christ. And then he offered his services to Venezuelan revolutionaries. The first one he offered his service to was a guy named Francisco de Miranda. And Francisco ended up being a pretty good person for McGregor to know. We'll see throughout this that McGregor uses people and throws them away. He had promoted McGregor eventually to brigadier general in 1812.
But he also, this guy Miranda, was really fascinated by the idea of kind of having a new Incan empire in South America, mm-hmm. like where the streets would be paved with gold and the trees would be overflowing with ripe fruit, and it would be just this like kind of Shangri-La or Eden type paradise, right? Mm-hmm. And this was a notion that I think he started implanting in McGregor's head that will kind of come out in this story very, very soon.
Yeah. Good call. So eventually things go wrong for Francisco de Miranda, who apparently had also, just a side note here, been knocking boots with Catherine the Great. Did you see that?
Just occasionally, I think.
Just occasionally. Uh-huh. They didn't want to put a label on it.
No.
You know what I mean? Yeah. They're very forward thinking.
It was complicated.
It was a time of revolution. So, unfortunately, Francisco de Miranda had been captured by Spanish forces, and he had been shipped off to prison, where he spent 4 years chained to a wall. MacGregor, however, despite losing his patron at this point, or his main connection with the military structure, he continues on his journey, and he makes a name for himself. People say, hey, have you guys seen how brave that guy is? Have you seen what a great leader he is? Or, more likely, I held my hand in front of the mic like I'm whispering. I want everyone to know that I did that, even though you can't see
it. You're still doing it.
I'm feeling this moment, Noel, because, yeah, they said he's courageous, and they said he was a great leader.
Look at those chops. Look at those beautiful, gorgeous mutton chops.
Right. Or did he just make up stories wherein he looked courageous and looked like a good leader?
Yeah, but that's the thing, though. In and around this time, and it'll become even more apparent once our boy kind of makes the trip back to his home country in London, things were not so good. People wanted heroes. They wanted to believe these kinds of stories. They wanted to look up to someone like this guy and be able to say, hey, look at that shining example of a man with those delightful mutton chops. I want to follow that guy.
That's a really good context to put on this, and I think you're absolutely correct. People need a hero, right? And whether he is a real hero or not, it's debatable. We'll leave that decision to you folks. Regardless, he rose from the position of staff colonel to the general of division in the Army of Venezuela in New Granada when he was only 30 years old. And he was kicking keisters and taking names. He fought in a ton of battles and
still leagued up with this Venezuelan revolutionary, right?
Right, right. And he became known for these epic campaigns. And his role in these pivotal, decisive battles attracts national attention. And Simón Bolívar, who we mentioned just a second ago, also comes in person to award MacGregor these various accolades for his actions in wartime.
Yeah, like serious accolades. He was awarded the insignia of the Order of the Libertadores, which was the name of the militaristic group that Bolivar headed up. And MacGregor was more than ready and willing to capitalize on these accolades, in order to earn some serious coin.
Yes. Yeah. He got married again to a relative of the Supreme Commander, Bolivar, and he also found that peace was sort of a letdown to him, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, not only that, it's just like, in peace, there's no money to be made.
And that's what he was after. Where's the next grift?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because, I don't know, it's weird. He's up to now, he certainly is part of some conflicts that make him seem like you could view him as some kind of like military genius or, you know, some kind of like war hero. But it does feel like he was rising in the ranks all the while, sometimes using payoffs and sometimes, throwing people under the bus and using people for their influence. But it all seemed pretty self-serving. But I don't know. Maybe that's just politics.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it is because he continued fighting his own kind of private war. And so after his time in Venezuela, where he finds peace anticlimactic and, let's be honest, not all that profitable, he leads a series of independent military campaigns in the Caribbean. And History.com has a great article on this by Evan Andrews, but I don't want to read the title yet because we don't want to spoil the story. He did something pretty interesting. He just arbitrarily would promote the people who worked for him, the different freebooters that he was hiring and mercenaries. And like, oh, I like the cut of your jib. You're a lieutenant now.
You're on my crew.
Right. And his big tent campaign in this period of his life was the brief capture of Florida's Amelia Island from the Spanish. He also was not the most impressive military commander, at least by this point. He was known to immediately desert his army.
There you go. Here's some chinks in the armor, Ben. Give it to me. Yeah, he was, because he cultivated this image of himself, mm-hmm. and then clearly that was more important than actually being, you know, a good guy or an effective leader.
Yeah, yeah. That's the truth. That's what we were alluding to earlier when we talked about his courage and his leadership. It turns out that he, as long as everything was going fine for his army, he was completely on board and 100% down for the cause. However, if things appeared to go south, sideways, or pear-shaped, as they say in the UK, he would ghost. But he still kept his knack for self-promotion and deception. So the accounts he would tell of various military conflicts differed from the accounts everybody else would tell. And he became known, at least in this area of the world, that's a very important detail, as a bit of a blustering braggart, but still a charmer, just very self-aggrandizing, and a guy who thought he was the smartest person in the room and was convinced that he could sell anyone on anything.
Yeah. And as we're going to find out, he kind of could.
Yeah. Yes. Should we just jump there?
Oh, we definitely should. We can jump there in the form of a slight lead up in that he kind of waged what the History Today article very astutely describes as a private war, where he included in that was that capture of that fortress that you mentioned. But most importantly, him and his associates, this band of brigands, I guess, that he sort of amassed, landed mm-hmm. on the mainland of Nicaragua, mm-hmm. Where there is a stretch of coast, a region called the Mosquito Coast.
Yes, also known as the Mosquito Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
This is an important part here. Nowadays, it's the eastern coast of Nicaragua and Honduras, just a little bit of southern Honduras shares this area. But the Mosquito Coast was generally thought of as the domain of the Mosquito or Mosquito Kingdom. And they had an interesting tension in this area between the British, the U.S., and the countries of Nicaragua and Honduras.
Well, not to mention the Native American, the Native people, the mosquito Indians,
Yeah. And we had a strange situation here because the Mosquito people had their own rulers or kings, and they had a specific name, right?
Yeah, that's right, Ben. They had something of a king who was called the cacique.
Yeah, a series of kings.
Yeah, series of kings. This is the cacique, king of the Mosquito Indians. And this individual made a bit of a devil's bargain with our boy McGregor.
Yeah, and so for context, the cacique, the kings of this area of the Mosquito people, allowed foreigners to settle in their lands so long as their overall sovereignty was respected. And a lot of British merchants and Garifuna people from Honduras took advantage of this. And one of these kings, one of these caciques, makes a deal with Gregor MacGregor for, I believe it was 30 miles of land?
That's right.
Yeah.
And it was on what's known as the Poyas Shore.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that land grant, that surely was on the up and up when mm-hmm. he made this deal, right? Surely all the T's were crossed and the I's were dotted.
I'm convinced.
Uh-huh, yeah. So with this deal having been made, McGregor makes his way back to England, to London in particular, making some pretty outrageous claims.
Right, yeah. So after he makes this deal in 1820, he becomes a whole new Gregor MacGregor. He is the Prince of Poyas. He's named his newfound dominion Poyas. And boy, is Poyas a great place. This is where we see the inspiration he received from Miranda's vision of a new Incan empire popping back up again. He described this place in very hyperbolic, fascinating, almost too good to be true-ish terms.
Yeah, like stuff like flowing with milk and honey, you know, fruit trees spilling with delicious ripe fruit, water so pure that it would quench any thirst, I think was one of them, right, Ben?
Mm-hmm. And he claimed he was the cazique, or the king slash prince of this area, and that this was an obscure but prosperous nation. And not only was it a hidden gem across the sea, but it was an act now situation. Because you see, Londoners, you too can be part of the dream. The cazique of Poyas has come on a mission to solicit investments and to recruit potential settlers.
That's right. And there's a super cool excerpt from a book by Maria Konnikova, mm-hmm, that is on the BBC, that talks about some of the psychological principles of persuasion, mm-hmm, that con men use, in particular, that Gregor MacGregor used. Do you want to talk through some of those?
Sure. Let's round robin it. There are six. The first is reciprocity.
Reciprocity. I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine. Coming from MacGregor, hey, I'm giving you this chance of a lifetime. All you got to do for me is give me all your money.
Mm-hmm. And then consistency of behavior, meaning that whether it is true or a lie, I am going to believe the same thing I did yesterday. Right?
That's right, exactly. Then we have social validation, which is super important because it's basically, like, if I'm saying to you, Ben, Ben, you got to do this. It's going to make you a real, real true Scotsman, a real true man's man, a Robinson Crusoe type, you know, going out and taming the wilds. And at the same time, it's going to be awesome. So don't worry about it.
Yeah. And there's a clever thing there, too, because the social validation there is, I have specifically chosen you to be part of this.
Yes, for your merits that are just on display, Ben.
And so
clearly
apparent, yeah.
I want you to be part of my new utopia.
Also, this is just between us. I like you as a person. That's number four. You know, we're friends.
We're friends.
We're buddies. We're pals.
Friends. Yeah.
You know, you're a pal with the cazique of Poya.
How cool is that? And here's a really important one. And you see, it's funny, you see a mix of these being used in everything from, like, offers on Facebook and things to, like, ticket sales. You notice how every time you see an ad for, like, concert tickets, they always say, they're really going quick.
Act now.
Going quick. Get them now. You got to get them while they're hot, because there's just not enough to go around because it's just such an amazing opportunity. And if you don't do it, somebody else will. So you better hop on it. And then finally, what do we have?
Yes, finally, authority. I know what I am talking about.
Oh,
says the grifter.
And not only that, this is my favorite part of this whole story, actually. MacGregor actually wrote a book.
Yes.
Under an assumed name called Sketch of the Mosquito Shore, including the territory of Poyas. And it was written by a man by the name of
Thomas Strangeways.
Thomas Strangeways. Captain Thomas Strangeways.
Oh, yes, pardon the hell out of me, yeah, Captain Thomas Strangeways.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, everything, all signs point to this was, in fact, MacGregor. So he was, like, laying the groundwork for this grift. This was a long con, man.
Yeah, and people did not have the same, I guess, I don't want to say wherewithal, but they didn't have the same resources we
access
would have,
to fact-checking.
Right, that we have today to verify information. So Thomas Strangeways, Captain Thomas Strangeways, just had a really interesting name, sounded like a great, well-traveled adventurer, and in very idyllic, bucolic terms, described this hitherto unknown nation of Poya.
Yeah, and he described it just as we described it, just as MacGregor described it, as this place. Oh, gold just overflowing from the river.
Everywhere.
Just everywhere, lousy with gold. And here's the thing with that authority point of persuasion, this is makes it even better because he's saying, don't take my word for it. Check out this guy, Captain Strangeways. He's been there. He wrote a book about it. Who would write a book about it if it wasn't true?
Yeah, I was quite delighted to find that my tiny, beautiful nation was the subject of a book you seem well-read. You've surely heard of the sketches, right?
Here's a little snippet. Yeah, a little snippet from the preface. Mosquito Shore, including the territory of Poyas, being impressed with a thorough conviction of the immense benefit which not only the native tribes of Mosquitia, but the neighboring countries in general must derive from the civilization and improvement of one of the fairest portions of the globe, has endeavored in the following sheets to attract the attention of enlightened Europeans to the subject, by combining the knowledge of its history, natural productions, the best mode of culture, and etc., which he acquired during a portion of his life spent in that part of the world.
Was that your Matt Berry?
I don't know. Kind of. It was. No, but so this is so meta, because this is McGregor writing a preface, like, you know, himself.
Four Strange Ways.
Yeah. Who is also himself.
And it's a long preface. We know that sounded like a long thing, but that's just an excerpt.
It's just an excerpt. But the point is from the start, it reads like a treatise for how awesome this place is. It's like a timeshare pamphlet.
Or an infomercial that purports to be a documentary, right? And at this time, now that he's reinvented himself as the Kazik, as His Highness Gregor, he is a fixture in London's high society. Wealthy aristocrats set him and his wife up in a country home. The Lord Mayor holds a banquet in his honor, and people start to trust him because he's charming and he cites all his past military achievements. And you know what? I've got to stop just for a second. Strange Ways is just such a terrible, terrible name. It's like Timmy McReal name.
Well, I mean, Gregor McGregor's not great either.
Yeah.
But it's real.
Yeah, but that's the real one. That's just so weird.
I'm not making fun of Scottish names. I just think any name where, like, the first name and the last name are the same, inherently absurd sounding to me. But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. There's, you know, Humbert, all that sort of stuff.
Exactly.
But even though he's Gregor McGregor, excuse me, His Highness, the Kazik Gregor, he is really and genuinely winning people over because he doesn't just come with great stories. He doesn't just come with a book that he didn't write. He also, you see, has tons and tons of official documents, all kinds of paperwork. He has a handwritten land grant from the Mosquito King, which is a great band name. He has a national flag. He has charts and maps showing the location and border of Poyas.
I think he even had some currency from the Bank of Poyas.
Yes, he has currency. I think they call it, what, one hard note?
Oh, and it says at the bottom, by order of His Highness Gregor, Kazik of Poyas.
Yes, and the problem with all this stuff— One hard dollar, which is a weird phrase.
A little bit.
Yeah, but the problem with all of this documentation is that almost all of it is entirely fabricated by him. He has made up these dollars.
Ben, do you remember that crazy fraudulent music festival called Firefest that happened last year?
With Ja Rule, I think
Ja Rule was involved. That's right. But basically what it was this total bait and switch where they were selling these premium packages to, you know, rabid bougie concert goers to go to this like private island where this concert was going to be held, and everyone showed up and they were expecting all these crazy accommodations, and
there was nothing.
It was just trash. It was these like crappy tents. There was just like, you know,
no
sand
food,
and no
waste
food
facilities.
Just totally filthy and absolute, you know, just complete grift. That's what the handful of hapless settlers who abandoned their homes for a better life under the benevolent hand of the Kazik of Poyas, that's what they found.
Well, yeah, it sounds crazy, but let's step back a little and see how it happened, because he floats a 200,000 pound sterling Poyas bond in the London money market, and then he also starts selling land and titles to would-be colonists. And you could get a pretty good deal. For just £11, you could purchase 100 acres of Poya farmland. And if you were a little more well-to-do, you could buy a post as an officer in the military, the same way the Kazik became.
Yeah. Well, you know, pay it forward.
You know, in the sleaziest way possible.
And how crazy that the value of those bonds you mentioned just ballooned over time.
Yeah. Yep. And in September of 1822, a ship called the Honduras Packet set sail from London with, as you said, a handful of people bound for Poya, probably with their land deeds clutched in their hands. And that first ship only took about, several dozen people.
Yeah, and there's a second one called the Kinnersley Castle. Mm-hmm. And I believe between the two, there was 250 folks in total. Right. And they were just expecting paradise, mm-hmm. you know, as well they should have, given, you know, the salesmanship of our guy MacGregor.
Yeah, so these people who are called Poyers, most of them invested their entire life savings in this journey. As you said, Noel, they sold their houses. Some had even converted all their cash to hard Poya's dollars.
Oh, shaking my head. I feel bad for these hapless saps.
Yeah, but, it's terrible.
You know, at the same time. Again, though, things were not so hot in the world at large. And certainly the kind of people that maybe would look at this as an opportunity to start again. You know, Scotland's pretty bleak. The weather's not great. It felt like maybe to some this was a way to break out of their kind of typical humdrum routine and start a new life for what seemed like a too good to pass up deal, which is another part of manipulative techniques of grifters, is the idea there's two notions. One is you're spurring somebody towards making a decision that you want them to make,
right,
and also making sure that the decision seems like something that it would be a fool to reject this offer because it's just like a no-brainer, right?
Yeah, and it's also very helpful. You know you've done well when they feel as though it is their own idea. Hey, Kazik, you and I are friends, right? You know what? Poya sounds so good that I would like to go. Napoleon has just been defeated. The British economy is expanding. And, you know, I'm in a good mood. I think it's a time to make a change, right? And this works very well for the Kazik at first, but for these poor investors, the Poya they were promised is not the Poya they find when they land.
No, it was that Firefest situation.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. They see no farmland. They see mile after mile of dense, nigh impenetrable jungle. And they are wondering, you know, where is all the crystal clear water? Where is all the abundant, rich soil we were promised? Where the heck is the civilization you told us about?
Here's a fantastic excerpt from an account of the time that was reprinted in The Guardian recently.
Yeah, this is from The Guardian Archive. It was in print the 25th of October, 1823, by the time that a couple of settlers had made it back.
So here it goes. When the emigrants arrived at San Joseph, nothing could exceed their anguish on finding, where they expected, a fine, flourishing town with nearly 2,000 inhabitants, only two or three ruined huts. The party exerted themselves vigorously, clearing away some stunted mahogany trees from about 600 yards of sandy ground and erecting a number of little huts and tents with blankets to protect them from the weather. Nearly all of their provisions, however, had been wet in landing, as they had been compelled to roll all their barrels for a considerable distance through salt water. The sun in the daytime was intolerably hot, and the nights were cold, with heavy rain. What ended up happening was a lot of people died. They got very sickened because the water was not that pure, clean drinking, you know, water that was described. It was brackish.
And contaminated with animal waste as well. So in a very short amount of time, I think 20 people died, and everyone who didn't die got sick, and along comes the real Kazik, the king of the Mosquito Indians. He visits them to see what's going on.
Yeah, who the heck are you guys?
Right. And we have an excerpt that explains this situation pretty well. Try to imagine the king's utter bafflement here. He afterwards sent a letter stating that he had made a grant of 30 miles of land on the Poya shore to Sir Gregor MacGregor 3 years ago, but that, quote-unquote, Sir Gregor, having until that time neglected to take possession, he considered the grant as void, and that had he then known Sir Gregor as he did now, he would never have made the grant. He would oppose the settlement of anyone belonging to Sir Gregor within his territory and prescribed, as the condition of their remaining in peace, that they should abjure Sir Gregor and swear allegiance to him.
So in other words, he became aware of what a bastard Gregor was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Utter bastard. And so at this stage, he also threatens some of these settlers. He says, and we'll paraphrase here, that he could call up 7,000 natives and cut off the entire settler community at one blow. But by this point, and by their own admission, the settlers felt themselves past fear. Death was killing everybody off just as surely as the Mosquito King was threatening to do.
Bad times, man. There's a really sad little account of a man who was a shoemaker who was declared to be the official shoemaker of the Princess of Poya, whoever that was.
Yeah.
And he apparently got so sick that he took his own life by shooting himself while laying dying in a hammock.
Yep. And six men tried to get to Honduras in a canoe. They ended up being castaways, but they were rescued by a guy named Mr. Bennett, who was a mahogany merchant and an overall stand-up dude. He learned of what was happening.
Thank God for Mr. Bennett, man.
Yeah, and he sent a ship to take as many settlers as he could to a hospital in Honduras and to fetch the rest of them on the second trip. However, at this point, the situation is still fraught with danger because we mentioned Honduras Package, right? That's the first ship with about 50 people. We mentioned Kennersley Castle. That's the second ship with about 200 people. Mm-hmm. There were two other ships on the way. There was the Albion, which was the third vessel to bring settlers. It was diverted to Belize after they discovered that the previous settlers had abandoned camp.
This is so Firefest, dude. This is this is literally what happened with Firefest. People got trapped on the island.
Yeah, they couldn't fly out.
A much bougier version of this, but I wonder if Ja Rule or whoever the hell was responsible for that looked at this story as like an inspiration.
Yeah, and the other ship, the Skeen, was sent bringing arms and supplies, also diverted to Belize. And there are also reports that five other vessels were on the way. But in a massive stroke of luck for these vessels, word reached Britain that Poya was entirely made up by that time. So the British Royal Navy intercepted these other five ships and turned them back. And again, this all happened because there was such a scarcity of information and it took forever to contact people, especially over those long distances. All in all, MacGregor's swindle here raised £200,000. But Noel, what happened when people found out about this?
Well, they were justifiably enraged, and they were thirsty for MacGregor's blood. But by this point, he had already hightailed it out of the country and posted up in France, where I think he ran a few years more of other scams on the hapless Parisians. Oh, and by the way, if we're going to inflation calculator that amount of money that he raised,
sure,
it would be in the billions of dollars.
Oh, yeah, if we count France, there's a great article from The Economist called The King of Con Men that does the math for us here. Over his lifetime, those bond market frauds in England and in France run to the tune of 1.3 million. And in today's terms, how much is that?
That would be 3.6 billion.
Mm-hmm. Pounds. So that's
pounds,
even more dollars.
Even more. It's crazy. And yeah, and so a big part of this, I guess, once he got to Paris, too, I mean, I don't know, it must have been part of it from the start, but this idea of these gold mines, you know, selling these parcels of land with the promise of these imaginary gold mines that people would just be able to just, like, stick their hands in the water and just get gold right
on. It's lousy with gold.
Lousy with with gold. But for whatever reason, in this History Today article, they conjecture that maybe Paris was a little too hot for McGregor and his crew. They came back to London. And yeah. Thank God there's a little comeuppance here. They were arrested on site and imprisoned in a prison called the Tothill Fields.
Yeah. We should note, though, that when he was in France, he was doing the exact same scheme. He didn't even change the name of the country. I think that's part of why he was so quickly caught, you know?
And I think I may have spoke too soon, Ben. Yeah. That comeuppance was maybe just the humiliation of being arrested. But as slippery a snake as this dude was, he was able to wriggle his way even out of this one.
Yes, that is true. He was in Tothill Fields Bridewell for about a week before he was released without a charge. And then immediately he starts a newer version of the Poya scheme. And this time he calls himself Cazique of the Republic of Poyas. He sets up a new office and doesn't claim any of the diplomatic status that he had done with the other office. And he starts acting through proxies. He gets another company to act as brokers.
Yeah, so he basically smartened up his grift a little bit.
Right.
And separated himself from it somewhat.
Right. And he started selling other versions of this. By the time it hit 1828, he was selling certificates entitling holders to land in Poyas proper at 5 shillings per acre. He goes on publishing these various documents. Paper is power at this time.
Oh, yeah.
So he publishes.
I mean, if it's printed, it must be true.
Right. Why would you go to the trouble? He publishes a constitution for a smaller republic headed by himself as president. He eventually, despite all his efforts, has a bit of a come to Jesus moment, as they would call it in the American South. And he understands that the Poya grift is finally done.
It's run its course.
Everybody knows.
Yes, everybody
knows. The
horse
is dead.
Yeah, because he's burned through all his money at this point. He's got no friends left to speak of. And so he goes back to the last place where he felt beloved, which was old Venezuela, where he still had some connects. He didn't screw anybody over there exactly, right, that I can think of. So he went back and actually petitioned the government to give him citizenship and restore his military rank. So he ended his life living in Venezuela as a general and got a government pension.
Yeah, back pay as well and pension. And that's primarily because the defense minister had served alongside McGregor in an expedition in 1816 and said, you know what, this guy is a war hero. And this worked. The part of today's Honduras that was called Poya remains undeveloped today. There are no villages, no abundant farmland, no gold mines that anyone knows about. But McGregor himself, old Gregor McGregor, passed away a free man on December 4th, 1845. One of the greatest grifters ever lived, and just an utter sleazebag.
You gotta admire the stones on this guy, though, man. I mean, good Lord. Just to keep it rolling like this for so long. Oh.
Yeah. But hopefully, a lesson to be learned. And we hope that you enjoyed this episode as well. Thanks so much for giving us a listen.
Yeah, enjoyed. It's another one of these where, yes, it's ridiculous, but God, this guy put some people through the ringer. But, I enjoyed learning about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, tell us what you think. And, no. Really?
Annoying.
It's time, gentlemen.
Jonathan Strickland, the Quizster.
Speaking of time,
yeah,
it's been a nice little stretch of time since you've darkened our studio door.
Operative word being a nice stretch, you know.
I heard so many complaints about my absence that I could not allow it to continue one breath longer. And so the most cringeworthy segment in all of podcasting has returned.
I'm certainly cringing.
You're also on a t-shirt.
I am.
This has gone too far, some might say.
It's a top seller.
So this is our non-consensually recurring segment wherein you, the Quizster, also known as Jonathan Strickland.
Just kind of materializes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Rises my want.
Right when we think we're going to end the show, to test our knowledge of historical fact and fiction. How does this work?
I present to you a scenario, and I give you 3 minutes to determine whether said scenario, in fact, represents fact or I made it upsies. And I could have made up a significant fact within the story and the rest of it be mostly true, and it's still fakesies.
Oh, wow.
Right? So okay. You ask me this every time, so I thought I would just get in front of it this
time.
There
we go, yeah.
Because it's like you forget how this game works every time I come in here. So
it's not for our benefit, man. It's for the new listeners who just hear this weirdo popping up out of nowhere, and they want to know what gifts.
I'm just making sure, because every time Ben says it, it's like he legitimately doesn't remember.
Yeah,
I'm a little concerned.
I've got a pretty good acting range or some emergent issues.
Ben's got like it. The memento guy.
So if it's either all true or it's fake. So I give you the scenario, and then I come up with some sort of arbitrary rule for you to follow if you want to ask me a question, which I now realize I did not think about before I came in here today. So we're going to say, if you wish to ask a question once the time has started,
mm-hmm.
you will preface that question with, "Allons-y."
Allons-y?
You'll understand why in a moment.
Allons-y.
I will now read to you the scenario, and then at the conclusion, we will start the clock. All right, here we are. On August 21st, 1911, one of the greatest art heists in history took place. A man who styled himself the Marquis Eduardo de Valfierno calmly walked into the Louvre in Paris, France. He waited until no one was paying attention. He lifted Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa off the wall, slid it under his coat, and calmly walked out of the building. He had already sold the Mona Lisa to an interested buyer. Actually, he had sold it to 6 different interested buyers because he had no intention of parting with the real painting, you see, but rather had 6 forgeries made. It was the perfect crime. The people purchasing the stolen painting would surely not say anything about it, and they'd have no way of knowing about each other. An accomplice named Vincenzo Perugia was caught, supposedly with one of the forgeries, according to this marquis. Perugia would be tried for the theft and sentenced to serve out a jail sentence. The copy, the forgery, according to Valfierno, would go to the Louvre, where it hangs still. Valfierno told his story to journalist Carl Decker of the Saturday Evening Post years later. The whereabouts of the original Mona Lisa, according to Valfierno, are still unknown. Begin the time.
Okay, first off, there's a lot of according too going on in here. So that guy could be lying, but the story about the lie could be true.
Yeah, that's a good point, Ben. I don't know. You think it's just to throw us off?
I don't know. In the past, the longer ones have been false, but I messed up on that point because I mentioned it in front of Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. the Quizster.
And he made a face?
Yeah, he made I'll remember that face.
A bit of a smirk.
Allons-y.
Yes, Monsieur Bolin.
Does anybody else corroborate this story told to the journalist, or is it just the one guy?
Oh, no, there have been several corroborations.
Okay. Several credible corroborations?
Are you asking me to levy judgment upon those who corroborate the story?
That does seem like a stretch, Ben.
To answer your question, the one account of this, full account of this, is in a 1936 Saturday Evening Post article.
I seem to recall the Perugio.
I apologize. A 1932
the name
article.
As being an art, like a high art thief.
Yeah.
Or some, like there was a movie or something about it. Mm. But I'm wondering if there was some detail that was incorrect.
Right.
That renders the whole thing.
Allons-y.
Oui, Monsieur Bolin.
What is the name of the thief again?
It would be Marquis Eduardo de Valfierno.
Who was Perugio?
Perugio was an accomplice. Vincenzo Perugio.
Okay. That's the name that
rings a bell.
Rings a bell.
You want to go for true?
I'm going to go for true.
All right, let's lock it in. 3, 2, 1, true.
Oh, I feel so guilty. This one's a tricky one. But no, it's false. It's actually false. You see, you're on to something, Monsieur Bolin. You see, this story was in fact told in the Saturday Evening Post in 1932, but Carl Decker was a notorious fibber.
Oh, man.
Notorious. And there is absolutely no proof that this ever exists. None of these supposed 6 forgeries have ever surfaced.
Uh-huh.
The examination of the Mona Lisa at the Louvre has shown that it is, in fact, the original Mona Lisa. In 1911, the Mona Lisa was not even a famous painting outside of France. No one knew about it.
Yeah, but Perugia did steal the Mona Lisa.
Perugia did steal the Mona Lisa in 1911 with 2 Italian accomplices. They spent the night in a janitorial broom closet, woke up in the next morning, and then, well, didn't even wake up. They stayed awake the whole time. Snuck out the next morning with the Mona Lisa. Perugia kept it, was afraid to try and even fence it for almost 2 years. Finally tried to do it in Florence, and the art dealer in Florence said, hang on.
Oh, wow.
Alerted the authorities. Perugia was, in fact, arrested and tried for the crime and sentenced to jail. You know how long his sentence was for stealing the Mona Lisa, one of the most famous paintings in all the world?
More than a year.
8 months.
8 months, that's
Eight
all.
8 months was all. The Mona Lisa was not very famous in 1911. Yeah. And also there was another event that ended up superseding, eclipsing, you might say, this story. And that little event was the Great War.
Right.
It broke out in Europe. And that no one really cared about an art thief at that point. But yes, so the story was published. Carl Decker did write an article that made these claims, saying that he had met this Marquis Eduardo Valfierno back in 1914. But there is no proof that such a man ever existed, no proof that any forgeries were ever made. And in fact, there are many parts of his story, Decker's story, that resemble an earlier story that was published in 1910 about another self-styled nobleman, Count Dalby, who was known to sell forgeries to American millionaires.
You know what, though? Okay, first off, thank you. That is an excellent explanation. But I am going to argue that this is a draw due to the complicated and unexplored territory that this question represents.
It's funny because I'm the one who's in charge of the game. I say I win. Besides which, you said the last time that it was an easy one. So now on, they're going to be really hard.
That was me. Sorry, guys. You know what, though? You've worn me down to the point where I just can't even get upset about this anymore. And I'm fine with just, I'm a glutton for punishment. Let's keep this rolling. Let's do it again.
We'll make it fair. Next time I make one up, I will make one up. I will not take some other famous fraud and then present it as if it were true, because you may remember, hearing that story.
That's right.
Is it a real story?
Trixie, devil.
I'll be more honest in my dishonesty moving forward.
Great. Well, you're a clever antagonist for sure, and this would usually be a great Casey on the case moment, but he will have to recuse himself because he is actually friends with all of us and may have a difficult time being impartial. However, we do want to thank you for coming on the show and helping us and our fellow Ridiculous Historians learn a little bit more about Art Heist.
And I hope the sheer length of this one made up for the last 2 shorties that we put out.
Oh, there we go. That's a good way to look at it. Uh-huh. You're nailing these
what
things.
What I lack in quality, I make up for in quantity.
Indeed.
So we want to thank everybody. Of course, thank you, Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister. Thanks to Christopher Hasiotis, our research associate for today's episode.
Thanks to super producer Casey Pegram, Alex Williams, who composed our theme. Jonathan, I can take him or leave him. And thanks to you, Ben.
Hey, thanks
big,
to you, Noel.
Big thanks to you.
Merci beaucoup.
Oh, man. Allons-y.
Dorian.
Whatever. And thanks to you, folks, listening public. For listening.
Yeah, find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. You can join our community page, which we're big fans of, Ridiculous Historians. Jonathan drops by there as well on occasion. If you want to learn more about Jonathan when he is not in his alter ego, you can find him on Tech Stuff and several other shows. Isn't that correct?
Mm-hmm. Tech Stuff is a primary show, and I've got other ones coming up soon. And
you're trying to trick me, Bolin. We're still arch nemesis.
Yeah.
But thank you for the shout out.
Oh, yeah, of course. And that's it. Noel, do you want to go out and grift some people? Like in a harmless, fun way?
Well, like steal candies from some babies or something?
Yeah, do some Dennis the Menace type grifting.
Victimless crimes.
Yes.
Sure.